Well, what if I told you that I have a secret life? Would you worry? Would you whisper or talk? Maybe I should say, it's probably not what you think it is, the secret life you might imagine, just so you won't worry about me too much. It's like this. For as long as I can remember, I have wanted to be a writer. When I was a little kid, I would collect little scraps of paper and fold them over into little books, and I would write little stories in them. And as I grew older, I began buying books about how to write a book. I have lined many publishers' pockets purchasing books about something I'm not actually doing at the time. Another way that I've tried to break into this world of my dreams as a writer is that I've signed up for a lot of writers' conferences or writers' workshops. But that comes with a lot of imposter syndrome for me, too. You know, that feeling like you're the only one that doesn't belong in the room. I end up sitting in rooms full of people who are actually writers when I always feel a little bit like a wannabe writer. Somebody whose life is so full of other things, full-time dean, full-time mom, full-time everything, that writing is so part-time as a dream that it just gets put way on the back burner. Like maybe not even on a burner at the time. So sometimes I sign up for writers' workshops or conferences to get me from this place where I feel like a wannabe writer to a place where I am actually writing. So a few years ago, I signed up for one of these writers' conferences, and it was in beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico. And here's the first thing I learned. You have your pens out? Ready to take notes? Writers are weird people. I'm not joking about that. I can say that because I am a full-time dean and a full-time mom, so I only have time to be a part-time writer, so I'm only part-time weird. These folks, they were full-time weird. Do you remember that kid in school, all the way at the back of the room, who was either staring out the window daydreaming all the time or scribbling furiously in these notebooks? That kid grew up to be a writer. These folks were full-time daydreaming, scribbling, weird people. And they were also really wonderful people. And here's the thing, that's not my secret life. This is. Writing isn't a secret in my life. Pastoring sometimes is. I go to these conferences for writers, and I don't really tell anybody what my day job is. I find it kind of complicates things in some spaces to tell people what you do in ministry. Like in the writing class I was in that one time where a guy performed a spoken word poem about running from the police after his encounter with a prostitute. I found it's just really helpful if all the heads in the room don't swivel to look at me to see if I'm judging people or not. So when people at these things ask me what I do, I'll say, I'm in education. Or public speaking, or marketing. Marketing for Jesus, it's a thing. It's all true. You guys are my secret life when I'm with writers. So while I was being my secret self at this writers' conference, I got to know some really wonderfully weird people in my morning workshop, which we were assigned to for a whole week. We were all in different workshops in the morning. Some people in poetry, some in fiction, some in screenwriting, some in songwriting. I was in one called spiritual writing. And we all agreed that we didn't really know what that was. But I was hoping that it would mean for me some help with this thing where I'm trying to stop saying I want to be a writer and start saying I am a writer. And during this conference, we spent our mornings in these workshops, which evidently was also a verb, because we were going to be workshopping our writing. And here's what workshopping meant. We were supposed to bring a significant piece of our writing work, and then everyone was going to read it. And then they were going to tell you what they liked, but mostly did not like about it. And hopefully you would get better at what you do. Sounds great, right? Also terrifying. If you create something, If you really pour your heart into it, you can get pretty attached to it. So if you're a writer, you might feel about your writing like you might about your firstborn child. And putting it on a table in front of a bunch of other people is like saying, here's my baby. Now tell me everything that's wrong with it. It's a little scary. And guess who got to go first? It was me. So the first day we sat down in this class, and the teacher, who was not wannabe a successful published author, asked everyone to get out my piece, my baby, and start workshopping it, talking about what was wrong with it so we could make it better. First, they asked me to read a piece of it aloud. So I started at the beginning with the introduction, which was really the introduction to the first character in my piece. I was going to tell a story about. I started reading quietly and carefully out loud. When I met her, Tara was a single mom of three with tattoos on her wrists and a million bumper stickers covering her station wagon. It was clear that she adored being different. At the office where we worked together, she came in giddy one day talking about this amazing guy she met out while she was inline skating in the city streets with her 16-year-old son, whom she had given birth to when she herself was 16. She and this guy she met, they started dating, and later they got serious, and they got married in a skate park with the whole wedding party on wheels. Tara gave birth to their daughter, Grace, in the back of that station wagon since they got stuck in traffic on the way to the hospital. It seemed like Grace liked the idea of life on wheels as well. Now, I wanted to go on. I wanted to get to the really good part, which was Tara's story, but it turns out that no one gets to the really good part unless you have a really good introduction. So we stopped. We were going to stop and talk about just those first two paragraphs. And during this next part, while they talked, I wasn't allowed to talk at all. And I think I was holding my breath. I felt like I might even pass out. Then they started talking about me like I wasn't even in the room. One guy said, I want to know more about the narrator. Hello, right here, narrator. I want to know why she cares about Tara. Why is Tara's story so important to her? Another person said, I want to be able to see Tara, not just hear about her, but see her. What does she look like? How does she carry herself? Don't just tell me she's different. Show me. And that's when the teacher got up and walked over to the whiteboard in the room where he wrote something in scrawling print with a dry erase marker. It was just three words. He wrote this. Show, don't tell. Show, don't tell. Don't just tell me about someone, show them to me in your writing. Show, don't tell, he said, was one of the cardinal rules of writing. Don't just tell me that Tara is different. Show me her tattoos, her mannerisms, her posture, her t-shirt. He went on to say that the Russian playwright Anton Chekhov had a famous line about this rule. The rule, show, don't tell. Chekhov said it like this. Don't tell me that the moon is shining. Show me the glint of light on broken glass. Show. Don't tell. It's a much more compelling style to read, but it is so much harder to write. Anyway, we spent a long time talking about that and workshopping about what it meant to show and don't tell, how a writer could have lots of good intentions, but unless it becomes visible, unless it becomes concrete to the reader, the writing falls flat. And what happened next really got my attention because our teacher walked over to the whiteboard again and wrote what he said was another line by the Russian playwright Chekhov, only it sounded a little more familiar to me. Right under show, don't tell, on the board, he wrote this Chekhov quote, faith without works is dead. Anton Chekhov. And I swiveled my head looking around to see if anyone else noticed, but they were all busy scribbling it down in their little notebooks. Faith without works is dead by Anton Chekhov. And my secret life was welling up inside of me. but it was preventing me from shouting out, that's actually in the Bible. Chekhov didn't say it first. That's James chapter 2, verse 17. Faith, unless it's accompanied by actions, is dead. But it turns out that God sneaks around in secret identities sometimes too. And it was my writing teacher who wrote those words on the board, but I could tell the moment I saw it that it was God's handwriting. Faith without works is dead. Christians make a big deal out of that line. We talk a lot about how we're saved through faith alone, that we can never earn God's love and acceptance, nothing but the blood, right? And that's a good thing because none of us could ever be good enough. It's a good thing that God takes us just as we are, but sometimes, and I've done this myself at times, we can take advantage of that part of God's heart. We can take for granted that no entrance fee kind of God that we have. Since we don't have to do anything to get God to love us and accept us, we start acting like we don't have to do anything once we love and accept Him. The thing is that faith was never meant to be a minimum entrance requirement to heaven. Once faith gets a hold of you, it shakes everything up. Something inside of you changes, and then everything inside of you changes. It begins to remake you from the inside out. And when the faith that's inside makes its way outside, it becomes visible in something that we call works on the outside. Faith is what you believe. Works is what you do as a result of that belief. They're never meant to be separated at all. We don't do things to make God love us. That happens whether you like it or not. We don't do things to pay Him back. None of us could ever do that, but we do because we honestly can't help it. We can't help acting out on the outside the change that's come on the inside. Don't just tell me you follow Jesus. Show me. Show, don't tell. So how is that supposed to happen in my writing? Well, I took another shot at it, a revision. I tried again. You want to hear it? Tara's dilapidated old station wagon rattled into the space next to mine as I made my way into the office where we worked. The back end of her Vista Cruiser was obscured by dozens of bumper stickers like, "Why be normal?" "Horn broken. Watch for finger." There were so many there, they almost covered up that tiny little Christian fish symbol that seemed to be peeking out. We barely had a time to exchange hello as we both hurried to get inside. Both of us were almost late for an important Monday morning staff meeting. I squeezed into the conference room close enough behind her to see that her pixie short haircut was still wet. The second earring in her left ear, a long chain with a tiny silver dagger at the bottom, was dangling close to her shoulder. The tension as we squeezed into that room was so thick as we slipped in the door. This was no normal weekly staff meeting. I could see eyebrows go up as a few people glanced at Tara's choice of outfit for the important day. Fraying jeans, a concert t-shirt she had cut the sleeves out of, paired with her favorite pink sports bra peeking out underneath. At 5'1", Tara was tiny but fierce. You forgot her size instantly when she began to talk passionately about one of her many causes, her favorite of which were her children and Jesus. Jesus, who had helped her raise her babies alone since she had had her first one at age 16. We were all a little tense, this meeting, since it was the first time the big boss, the owner of the whole company, was coming down from the top floor to our little department staff meeting. I'd really only had a face-to-face conversation with him once when I went with fear and trepidation to his office for my interview as a staff writer, my very first job that ever paid me to write, me, a first-year seminary student from Texas looking for a part-time job. We didn't see the big boss much. Mostly we heard him. We heard his voice over the intercom, shouting for people, shouting for his secretary. If he didn't get the answer he demanded immediately, he would bellow like a big jowly infant. his voice echoing over the hall speakers throughout multiple floors of the building. If you were on the top floor, you would see the other assistants scramble around like ants, even searching the bathroom to find his current secretary. In the 2 years that I worked there, he went through 7. I'll stop reading there, because the thing was, my boss was a Christian, or at least he said he was a Christian. He was also a rageaholic. He talked about Jesus constantly. He was famous for grilling every employee who had a rage-filled performance review in his office to ask if they were saved. Maybe that was his idea of evangelism, I don't know. He once terrified employees by having people come in and pray over their doors, anointing the doorposts to make sure evil spirits didn't get in. Imagine not being a Christian and having someone chanting over your doorpost about evil spirits. When he determined that evil spirits were still somehow finding a way in, he had people go back and pray over the heating vents to see if that's where the spirits were getting in. And after a few short months of working for this guy, I was pretty sure I knew where the evil spirits were coming in. And that they had taken up residence in the corner office of the top floor. But that wasn't something that you said if you wanted to keep your job. My boss had faith, or at least he talked about having faith. But what came out of his mouth and what came out of his life were definitely two different stories. Do you know what the book of James says about that? You do. That kind of faith is dead, deceased, necrotic, rotting, decomposed. It's dead because it can't produce life or faith in others. I know my boss drove way more people away from Jesus than he brought to Jesus. And this kind of dead faith, this lifeless faith that James talked about, it's been in the news a lot lately. This disintegration of Christian leadership has hurt a lot of people through scandals and cover-ups and church hurt and abuse of power. People who speak Jesus with their lips and hurt people with their lives. And we're all mad about it. I mean, really mad. It hurts people we love, and it hurts the witness of Jesus Christ. It's easy to point fingers outward and say that their lack of integration between faith and works is a problem. But it's actually a problem in us too, because sin doesn't discriminate. And it's not just on the top floor in the corner office. Faith without works isn't just dead because it hurts other people, it also strangles the person who is trying to live this double life. It's hard and exhausting work to try to live a two-faced life because one will always be at war with the other. I know it's exhausting because I have been there. I've had moments in my life where I was telling people one thing about Jesus and turning around and acting like anything but a follower of his. You have been there too. You've been in places where you've proclaimed one thing about your faith, believed one thing, but done another with your body or your attitude or your hidden motivations or your screen time. Maybe one of these colors of ribbons over here reflects a place where you're saying one thing inside but doing another outside. And honestly, this is lifelong work for Christians. Faith and works being integrated, this is not just the basics, friends. If it were, it wouldn't be making the news. Getting our outside actions to catch up with our inside beliefs, it's work that Jesus promises to do in us. With our surrender and our willingness, it's his strength, his power that enacts it. So that we'll get to the point where we're not just wannabe Christians, like I was a wannabe writer, but actual living and breathing images on the outside of our faith inside, people who can show and tell. That is exactly the kind of Christian that my friend Tara was. Ironically, Tara, who looked so different from everyone in the room, like our former boss, well, maybe not like our former boss, Tara was a Christian. One of her favorite t-shirts to make people mad with was, "I love Jesus, but I cuss a little." She looked maybe more like she belonged at a rave or a roller derby than in church. The tattoos on her wrists were actual Hebrew words for the names of God, some of the most ancient names, marking her to remind her that she belonged to him now, these labels as plain as shackles on any servant. She had given herself to him because Jesus had bought her freedom from slavery that she had been in her whole life to so many things, and now she was his. And while her outer packaging looked like nothing my grandmother would recognize as a Christian, or what most people would expect, her works, man, her works were amazing. You could not help but notice them, even in this office environment. The way she trusted Jesus to take care of her and her kids, the joy that came out of this woman, even though I knew her life was incredibly difficult. The way she was always helping others, giving of herself, even though I knew she had so little, it was incredible. To know Tara was to hear the gospel. It reminded me of a line that I used to hear Christians say a lot. So often, in fact, it almost became a cliche. Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. That's kind of a Christianese way of saying show, don't tell. Make sure your works are speaking so loudly that your words don't have to be heard. But sometimes that phrase has bothered me. I don't know if it's ever bothered you a little bit. Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. As if your life could just do all the preaching for you. So you could just keep your mouth shut and live a secret life. And never have to risk doing that scary thing where you have to talk about your faith with others. I grew up in an incredibly loving little church, a church that showed the love of Christ so consistently. My parents were divorced before I was a year old. My mom and I became members of this little church, and we attended it, just the two of us together, every time the doors were open. She sang in the choir, which was in a choir loft on Sunday mornings, which means she sat up front. And from the time I was about 4 years old, I sat by myself in the pews of this church. Before that scares you a little bit, a four-year-old alone in church, know that my mom could give me the look just as easily from the choir loft, and it was just as effective. But also know that I never really sat alone in church. Every Sunday, I sat with my family, my church family. I was embraced by all of these different families, and every week, I sat with someone who loved me well and showed care for me. This church basically raised me. I never had a broken home because I had a church home. And when I was a little older, I went away to a Christian camp where people were talking about Jesus openly and excitedly. They shared with me, the first time I really grasped it, that Jesus wanted a relationship with me. They talked about Jesus like they had just had coffee with him that morning. Maybe they had. They talked outwardly about God and what a huge difference he was making in their lives every day. The way they openly shared their faith about Jesus made him feel real and present, like someone I could cuddle up next to in church. And when I went home to my little church after camp, I was startled to discover that they were of the same faith that those demonstrative Christians I had met at camp were, and it made me feel a little angry. Like, why didn't you tell me about Jesus? You showed me so well, but I don't really remember people telling me why they loved me so well. They showed, but they didn't tell. And it made me have this kind of holy discontent feeling with the church. Do you have one of those? This feeling where I just wished I could bring those two together, a loving community that demonstrates the love of Christ, but openly shares and tells the reason why they shared that love. I have spent so much of my ministry trying to find and create and nurture Christian communities like that, that show and tell. If you have a feeling about something that's not right in the world or in the church, that's called a calling. If you walk around thinking, God, that's not right, that is God tapping you on the shoulder to find the works that will make it so. Sometimes in the Christian community, even in seminary, we find ourselves afflicted with this kind of holy politeness where we might just not say Jesus' name too much, might not tell what he's doing for us. Sometimes we keep our faith in, not to risk seeming like we're doing or saying the uncool thing, kind of like being the pastor at a table full of writers, living some kind of secret life, not to risk being the wrong kind of weird. But I found if I am in a community that openly shares the love of Jesus and what God is doing in their lives, then I am more willing to openly say what Jesus is doing in my life. So let's talk about him, friends. Don't forget to tell. Preaching the gospel with your life, with your actions, it's a great approach, so necessary. But if something is a really big part of your life, you can't help mentioning it. Am I right? How could I walk through my day without talking about Jesus out loud? I can't get through my day without talking about my husband or my adorable kids. Lots of times, ask the chapel team. Have I mentioned my adorable kids? All the time. So I think this show, don't tell phrase might be the right thing for writing, but the wrong thing for life. Maybe it's more like show and tell. You remember that activity in kindergarten where you were supposed to bring something that you really cared about, you were really excited about, and bring it to show your friends, but also to tell them because you couldn't wait to share with your friends the thing that was so important to you. That's how Jesus is for us. And maybe works is more like the compilation of everything that makes up your life, words and actions. Maybe, as a writer, I think a little more like the complete works of William Shakespeare, right? When I get to the end of my life, if there is something called the complete works of Jessica, there will be a lot of sermons in it, but there's also going to be a lot of long bedtime stories that start with Good Night Moon, and a lot of long talks with seminary students about faith and life and future, and a lot of long walks with friends as we try to figure things out together. All of those are works, if faith is part of them. When you get to the end of your life, what if there's something called the complete works of Emily, Tammy, or JC, the complete works of Haley or Matt or Jaden? What will make up those works? It'll be what you show and what you tell. And it's not anything that's going to earn your way into heaven. You couldn't do that if you tried. And it's not anything that will change how God feels about you one way or the other. But what will be in those chapters is how you shared your life in the open, how you showed and how you told. So don't just tell. It makes for weak writing and weak faith. I have resolved to stop saying, I want to be a writer. I am a writer. I write. Maybe it's time to take the wannabe off of some part of your faith that you've always wanted to reflect on the outside more of what you want to be on the inside. My writing group said to me, don't just tell us that Tara is different, show us. So I'm going to say the same thing to you. Don't just tell me that following Jesus makes you different. Show me. show and tell. Let's pray. I'm going to invite you to settle for a moment and connect with the Lord, the Jesus who is the reason that we are here. And consider if there's some part of your faith that is different on the inside than you've seen working its way out on the outside. Is there something that you would love to be more integrated, more alike in your showing as it is in your telling? Just ask God that question and sit with it for a moment. Lord, we want to bring you all of ourselves today. Our attitudes, our actions, our hidden motivations that no one sees but you. God, will you help us spot the places that have drifted and come today not with shame, because that's not your style, Jesus, but offering once again what is on this table, your sacrifice, your fully integrated and immersed incarnation. None of us has the power to integrate our inner and outer selves on our own. So Lord, help us. We're yours.